Moving up, I want to say that the previous speaker said he was honored to be here. I have to say I was shocked. Eric said it was the first person to tell me I'm an old man who's at the end of his career. Okay, here we go. Wetland soils history follows two tracks, one podology-oriented and the other soil chemistry-oriented. I'll cover the podology aspects, focusing on hydric soils and the development of hydric soil field indicators. My co-author, John, will look at soil chemistry applications, focusing on nitrogen cycling and nanoparticles. So, to podology. Over the last 40 years or so, podologists have worked to develop tools that identify the boundaries of jurisdictional wetlands, and we've come quite a ways in that regard. Let me give you a background on what a jurisdictional wetland actually is. It must meet three parameters in the landscape. It must have wetland hydrology, hydrophytic plants, and hydric soils. Hydric soils are those that formed under the conditions of saturation, flooding, or ponding long enough to develop anaerobic conditions in the upper part. Now, the thing to remember here is hydric soils are defined basically on chemistry or chemical conditions. They need anaerobic conditions, not just simply saturation. So our job as podologists was to come up or to identify signs, or what we call field indicators, that form only in these anaerobic or reduced soils. They usually have unique color patterns or formed by carbon accumulation, but our job over the last 40 years was basically to come up with the indicators that people can use to identify hydric soils. Now, in this talk for podology applications, I'm going to follow a four-step timeline that covers our history. First, deal with redox chemistry as a podologist sees it, then move into microsites of reduction. That'll take us to redoxymorphic features, and then end with my main topic, the USDA's field indicators of hydric soils. Now, I picked history of redox chemistry up to 1972 because that's when this publication came out. It's The Chemistry of Submerged Soils by F.N. Ponnamparuma. It's a classic publication, at least as far as I'm concerned, because it describes the basic principles of redox chemistry very simply, specifically as they pertain to wetlands. I read it just a couple of weeks ago for this talk, and I think from a podologist standpoint, the points made by Ponnamparuma are still valid today. A couple of quotes. He said, "The most important chemical difference between a wetland soil and an upland soil is that the wetland soil is in a reduced state." Notice he's talking about chemistry now, not just saturation or waterlogging. He says the wetland soil contains the reduced counterparts of oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, the oxides or hydroxides of manganese and iron, as well as carbon dioxide. He goes on to describe oxidation reduction reactions and how he creates the reduced state, and does it very simply for a podologist to understand. He says the redox reactions, of course, transferred electrons from a donor to an acceptor, and that organic matter is the main source of electrons for biological reductions. He doesn't go into the details of the types of organic matter and all that. He says if you got the organic matter, you're getting the electrons that you need. Now, this is a little bit of an exaggeration of what he says. These cartoons are not in his publication, but this is basically the points he makes. He says that oxidation produces electrons when two things are present, the organic matter and the bacterium. And we don't care which kind of bacteria are there, okay? But basically, the electrons are produced when organic matter is eaten. This guy takes a bite out of the apple, and out his rear end comes an electron and a proton. And again, this is the process of oxidation that we need to understand hydric soils. Reduction is the counterpart, and these are the principal reducing reactions for a wetland soil. Oxygen is reduced to water, nitrate to nitrogen gas, iron oxides to ferrous iron, sulfate to hydrogen sulfide gas, carbon dioxide to methane. These can also be illustrated with cartoons, but I don't have enough time, so let's just keep moving on. If you look for what you need in Ponnamparuma's article, you can pretty much find what you want, I suppose. And from my standpoint, he says, he lays out, these are the conditions needed to reduce iron oxides. And I would take it one step further. These are the four conditions needed to create a hydric soil. Organic matter must be present because it's a source of electrons. Air must not enter the soil. We have to have it saturated, otherwise oxygen dominates the redox reactions. Bacteria must be decomposing the organic matter, so we want warm temperatures. And dissolved oxygen in the water must be removed. The soil must be anaerobic. Have those four conditions met, you will probably have a hydric soil. Okay, that's all I have time for redox chemistry. Let's move into microsites of reduction, and I'm going to pick the date 1987. Reduction occurs where organic matter oxidizes, or where bacteria oxidize the organic matter, according to Panam Perumaa. And in 1987, Parkin, in a publication in SSSAJ, reiterated, or at least emphasized, that this happens, these redox reactions happen in spots in the soil, or microsites. And these are frequently around roots. Okay, so they happen in small areas. The entire horizon will generally not be reduced at one time unless it's saturated for a very long period. So microsites of reduction. Now you can see these in simple lab experiments. This is a giant ant farm on the left filled with red sand. Pond pine roots have grown down to 60 meter length to reach the bottom, and this is unsaturated. If you go turn to the right, this is what happens after 17 days of keeping this soil waterlogged. The black color is actually iron sulfide that's formed along the dead roots where those four previous conditions were met. So these are the microsites. The black, as I said, is iron sulfide. And it occurs originally around these small little zones where the dead roots are. When the soils drain, or you can see similar effects in a soil, when a soil drains, these gray colors produced in the microsites are shown here along roots. And again, those mark the four conditions that are needed to form a hydric soil. You can have what I've just illustrated really are microsites of reduction. Now, when a soil drains, the large pores drain first, air comes into those large pores, and iron, if it's still present in a reduced form, can move back to the channel and oxidize, forming these iron coatings along the channel. You can see it in my root box right here. These are also microsites of oxidation. So, from Panam Perumaa and Parkin, we've begun to realize that we have microsites of reduction as well as oxidation. Being podologists, our next step, of course, was to name those things and classify them. And that takes us up to redoxymorphic features. This is a modeled color pattern, common for a hydric soil. In 1992, soil taxonomy was modified to include names of these microsites of reduction and oxidation. And those are now called redoxymorphic features. We published them in this article, or this bulletin, Redoxymorphic Features for Identifying Aqua Conditions in 1992. And this laid out the new system where we gave names to the features of oxidation, such as iron masses, iron pore linings, iron depletions for those where iron has been removed, as well as the reduced matrix. I'm just going to illustrate some of them here. On the left, I've got the microsites of reduction, or at least one, just an iron depletion. That's this gray zone along the root channel here. The microsites of oxidation would be the iron mass parallel to that root channel, but not next to it, as well as iron pore linings, which are here just around the root channel itself. But now with redoxymorphic features, we name these things, and now we can measure them and put percentages on them for our hydric soil identification. The last step was to pull this together and come up with the field indicators of hydric soil, the things that field workers can use to identify hydric soils on the ground. The field indicators are fairly simple in concept anyway. They're layers of soil whose thickness, depth, color characteristics, and the abundance and contrast of redoxymorphic features have been rigidly defined. The depth is defined to the nearest centimeter. If you're off by that centimeter, you may not have a hydric soil. The field indicators, in my opinion, are based around three elements that undergo reducing reactions, thinking back to Panam Perumaa now, that undergo reducing reactions and leave signs in the soil that we can see that the soil was anaerobic or reduced. For example, when oxygen is reduced to water, the soil is anaerobic and carbon accumulates. So we can look at black layers of muck or peat or just black colors to identify hydric soils. When the iron and manganese are reduced, we get these red and gray colors or the redoxymorphic features, another thing we can look for in our layers. Last, and in my opinion least, sulfate reduction gives us the rotten egg odor, a very strong indicator, but not particularly widespread, and so it's less used less often than the others. Well, a group of us have worked for a number of years to put together the combinations of layers that we need to use to identify hydric soils across the United States. They were first published in Field Indicators of Hydric Soils in the United States and came out in 1996. These were the main editors of this issue, but it was a collaborative project that many people were involved in. Over 40 indicators were identified, and today these are now used to identify all jurisdictional wetlands for all federal agencies in the United States. I don't have time to go into these in detail. This is just one example. It's a depleted matrix. It's defined as a layer of soil at least 15 centimeters thick with a depleted matrix that is 60% or more chromatourless, starting within 25 centimeters of the surface. Basically, it just means you've got red and gray colors as shown on the right. If this layer starts within 25 centimeters, you've got a jurisdictional wetland in the United States. Now, future needs. I know I'm an old man, but I still look to the future a little bit. Three things that I want to mention for pedology changes that need to be implemented here. We need to train more field workers and regulators, as well as consultants, to identify hydric soils. We've got the tools to do it, but most people don't understand it, in part because we're not training enough soil scientists. Secondly, in terms of research, we need to identify field indicators of hydrology, because, again, this will have to be identified not by hydrologic tools, but by soil tools. We can do this using hydrologic models along with soil morphological patterns. Climate change is another area that we need to get into and are getting into in some degree. Using hydrologic models, again, that predict water table levels, we can plug in climate change predictions for temperature and rainfall and look to see whether the hydric soil boundaries are expanding or contracting. Haven't done a lot of work in that, but I think we've got the tools now to do it, and that's where I think we need to be going in the future. All right. You've heard from the old man, so now we're going to turn to the younger generation and talk about wetland soil chemistry, and this will be done by John White. John?
Thank you, Mike. When I was first contacted by Mike to give this talk, right at the very end of the conversation, he said, "So you're going to have about 10 minutes to give the last 75 years of soil chemistry and the future. Okay, goodbye." And I was like, "What? How am I going to do this?" So what I thought I would do is, since he's done a really nice job of setting up the history of the redox, talk a little bit about nitrogen, because it is one of the most consistent areas of redox chemistry that we've been looking at over time. And when I had first done the search of the ISI, I was looking for the word nitrogen and wetland. And nothing came up till about the 1970s. So I kind of scratched my head, went down the hall, and talked to Ron DeLon, who's been at it for about 45 years. And he said, "Oh, you've got to include things like swamp, paddy, a whole bunch of other terms, and all of a sudden you can get some of the articles that come up." But you can see, certainly, there's been an explosion in the last 20 years of articles that are looking at nitrogen. And primarily, it started here in the 1970s. Bill Patrick, somebody mentioned him earlier. I have inspiration every day when I go into work because I actually sit at Bill Patrick's old desk. And he had worked with a number of people in the early 70s looking at nitrogen cycling in paddy soils. Just to go back a little bit of a timeline, in the late 1880s, both denitrification and N-fixation were described. Ammonia fertilizers were starting to be produced, and then eventually the Haber-Bach process really got the industrial production of nitrogen fertilizers going. It was a boon for agricultural production, and in terms of wetlands, the focus was on conserving that nitrogen in the rice paddies so that you didn't get denitrification and the loss of them, because one, fertilizers are expensive in most places around the world, and you want to increase rice production. And it's only in the sort of the last half of the 75-year period that we've been forced to look at the environmental consequences of doubling the amount of bioavailable nitrogen on the globe. So we've taken a tremendous amount of N, and now we're really looking at the complicated nitrogen cycle to figure out how we can best mitigate the effects of having all this bioavailable N now down in the biosphere. I just wanted to go through a little short list here. Our understanding of redox chemistry has really exploded because we've got these improved methodologies, more sophisticated instrumentation. So instead of looking at one single process in one small soil sample, students today are really because of the high sample throughput, are able to look at more systems, compare systems, look at time series, spatial interactive effects, and even things that are much lower concentrations than previously were allowed. And therefore, we've got increased participation by a lot more people. So we're getting a lot more information across the globe. Looking into the future, I thought I would just try to focus on nanoparticles. That is certainly the hot topic of the day. The drugs and personal care products, the estrogen-like compounds are also one of these emerging contaminants. But the nanoparticles are found in paint, clothing, industrial, as well as domestic sources, and we come in contact with them every single day. Here's an example of it's used in a paint in this building where the surface of the building actually cleans itself so that it can always stay white by decomposing any organic matter that builds up on it. There are roads now that will purify the air using the nanoparticles. And I've got some examples here of where titanium dioxide can actually, and here's a little diagram showing the electron. You got superoxides formed, you got hydroxides formed, and that can actually break down or oxidize both organic and inorganic contaminants, and that's just triggered by the sunlight. One of the things about nanoparticles is that they are all surface. Right, so they don't fit a lot of our fate and transport models. They can be at separate particles, aggregated in groups. They can be inside a matrix. Or what makes them even more challenging now is that they have a lot of different functional groups. So the chemists now are trying to jam on as many functional groups to these nanoparticles as possible. But that's going to make, obviously, their understanding and their effects very, very difficult to quantify because you're going to get a huge range of these things in the environment. Recent estimates show that only about 75 to 85% of the nanoparticles get trapped in the wastewater treatment system, and then from there, there is about 25% that are discharged into the environment. And there they become, their toxicity is going to vary based on whether they're photocatalytic or what other functional groups are on them. And their effect on bacteria and treatment systems, specifically wetland treatment systems, is not going to be very well known. So we've got a lot of these types of particles, a lot of different functional groups. They're all surface, so they're very, very reactive. And this is just one of those areas where a lot of research is going to be needed. And not just not just for a wetland scientist or a podologist, but somebody had mentioned this earlier, that we really need to be working with the chemists who are putting the functional groups on those and the engineers that are actually placing these things out into the environment and to figure out exactly what the transport is, what's the source, and then what are some of the effects of those particles. With that, I'm done.